Hi guys, these are the worst date movies ever. My name is Greg Knox, and I thank you very much for joining me on the show once again. Now, on the last show, as well as reviewing Desperate Living by John Waters, I also did an interview with my very, very good friend Tom Dennett Cook on how I know him, how we met, and his history in film reviewing and things like that. And I thought it went really, really well. I hope you guys enjoyed it. So I thought, why not do another show like that for you today? So on the show, I have an interview with my very, very good friend Miroslav Hartmann, who is the managing director of a Triptych Art Gallery, on her recent exhibition of the work of H.R. Giger in Kiev, which I was very, very lucky to attend myself, and it was really, really awesome. Very, very lucky to have done that. And also for us to talk about Soviet war movies, and in my opinion, the best war movie of all time, Come and See by L.M. Klimov, which is actually being restored and remastered by Janus Films, possibly for release by the Criterion Collection this year, which is very, very exciting. So without further ado, here is my interview with Miroslav Hartmann. Enjoy. I was just thinking back to the last time that you were on the show, and you were talking about the H.R. Giger exhibition that you were doing in Kiev.
I obviously did a great job, because you used to say Geiger and now you say Giger, as is the proper German language way. So, yes. This 2019 has been a very intense year for me. So I was part of a team of curators who brought H.R. Giger, well, his art to Kiev for the first time. It was kind of my idea, which took about 3.5 years to put into practice, but I'm delighted that it's finally happened. It was okay. An amazing show.
When did you get the idea? What was it that inspired you to do that?
Well, I've been a fan of Giger's work since I was, probably about 2 or 3 years old. My dad used to have a lot of Taschen art books, you know, like coffee table, you know, art books. And I used to spend a lot of time flipping through them. And Giger was my favorite. So, you know, I had an affinity for that kind of dark aesthetic virtually from birth, for whatever reason. So, you know, Giger always was, you know, part of my worldview. And I remember sort of turning to Giger for inspiration, for instance, when I was doing my GCSE art project. You know, I kind of completed like a whole sketchbook of studies based on his work, and my coursework was based on his work. And, you know, it was kind of always in the back of my mind. And I met a Dutch collector called Radi van Soest, who knew Giger personally. I met him at my gallery in Kiev. He just, you know, walked in one day and we got chatting. And, you know, before I knew it, he said, I've been trying to bring Giger to Ukraine for 10 years. And, it, you know, it's never really, you know, never really come off. And I said, well, that's an amazing idea, and I would love to help you make that happen. So he put me in touch with the Giger Museum. And I kind of campaigned to persuade the Swiss embassy in Ukraine to help us bring this exhibition to Ukraine. We got 2 Swiss government grants to fund this. And basically, I was in conversation with the Giger Museum, and I, you know, they told me that H.R. Giger is so notorious that the Swiss government had never, ever supported him during his lifetime. And if I actually successfully convinced the Swiss embassy in Ukraine to support this exhibition, they would give the exhibits to us loan free.
Oh, wow.
The Yeah, the Giga Museum is a private museum, so a major source of income for them is, you know, exhibit loan. So, you know, it was mission impossible, but thanks to the outgoing Swiss ambassador to Ukraine, Guillaume Scheurer, whom it took me only 3.5 years to persuade that this was a good idea, the whole thing finally came together. And another important player in all of this was Simone Pidou, the deputy head of mission, and his wife, Carole Pidou, who's an art expert and curator. So I think she kind of helped, you know, weigh in on this. And of course, Marco Witzig, he was Giga's personal archivist and assistant for over 20 years. And he is he's a curator at the H.R. Giga Museum. He came to Kiev, and I mean the venue as well was amazing. We did this at the newly reconstructed Dolshenko Center. It was actually the first exhibition in the program of the new, you know, the new Dolshenko Center. So a pavilion was built, and we had 40 original artworks by Giga, including sculptures, including a full size xenomorph from the Alien movies.
And yeah, which was awesome.
It was very successful. We had over 10,000 visitors over a course of 5 weeks.
That's quite a lot of people.
It was quite a lot of people for Kiev in the summer, certainly. We weren't able to secure, so we had some advertising. So for instance, you know, we had a huge of like billboards on the underground, which was, you know, for me, that was certainly a first, you know, seeing like one of my projects, you know, being advertised in the public space.
Tricky
in a good way. Of course, you came to visit, you know, I'll be eternally grateful, because this is towards the end of the show when I was like really experiencing that professional burnout in the best possible sense. But, you know, we weren't able to secure, like, for instance, you know, light boxes in the, you know, just in the streets and stuff, because of, you know, the Kiev city administration thought that this wasn't suitable for children to see, you know, because Giga retains his controversial edge. So it was, you know, for an exhibition of, you know, a world-class artist that was marketed mostly kind of through, you know, through the press and through social media, I think we did very, very well.
So, I mean, would you say that then that this is like the proudest achievement of your sort of career as it stands?
It's certainly the biggest name that I have worked with so far. You know, the most famous artist with the widest appeal, because, you know, my primary focus is Ukrainian contemporary art. I've also worked with Soviet art. So another show that, you know, another exhibition that I curated was the Fallen Revolution Propaganda Iconoclasm exhibition at the University of Essex in 2017. That was for another anniversary. So, you know, we had the 40th anniversary of the Alien movie. We also had the centenary of the Russian Revolution in 2017. That was an exhibition that explored the Lenin's cult of personality, and it looked at recent events in Ukraine with the 2013-14 Revolution of Dignity, where hundreds of Lenin statues all over the country were toppled by activists. And that exhibition featured several paintings from my family's collection of Soviet art. So what I do is I try, you know, I have quite a wide portfolio of projects and interests. But my bread and butter is my fine art gallery in Kiev, the Triptych Gallery, which, you know, forms really the backbone of what I do as a professional. So we represent Ukrainian artists, sculptors, photographers. So the gallery has been around since 1988. But in the past 5 years, I've been running it, and, you know, our portfolio of artists has become a lot younger. We're working a lot more with emerging artists. You know, we're doing a lot of interesting stuff that, you know, crossing over into the kind of, you know, diplomatic realm, for instance. In November last year, I curated an exhibition called Idols, the Art of Heavy Metal.
Yes.
And we got support from the Royal Norwegian Embassy, and we brought together a young Ukrainian painter, Nikita Tsoy, a very famous Ukrainian sculptor, Ihor Hruchanik, and of course, Esther Sagara, the world famous extreme metal photographer. So, you know, it was a proud moment as well. It was a real kind of sense of satisfaction of kind of bringing your most intimate interests into, you know, the professional realm with this kind of diplomatic recognition, you know, and support. So that was fun. So, you know, although, yeah, absolutely, the Giga Show was the biggest thing I've done to date, but I'm also proud of the work that I do with less well-known artists, you know, including the Ukrainian artists that I represent and that I would really like to help gain more recognition both in Ukraine among collectors and art lovers and beyond.
Yeah, so that must give you like a lot of satisfaction then. So, I mean, has there been anyone who you've taken on, you know, shown their work at the gallery and then they become more well known just in Ukraine or
absolutely
beyond?
Absolutely. Yeah, so something that we've done increasingly, which was a radical departure for the gallery in the past few years, was, you know, we've had a lot of debut shows. So we've shown work by artists who, you know, who had just graduated from the Academy of Fine Arts or, let's say, you know, art school, or sometimes even artists who were still, you know, studying. So they're very early in their career, and doing a show at a gallery like ours just, you know, immediately lends weight to their portfolio. You know, we've had artists getting offers from other galleries in other countries even. So, for instance, a young artist called Daira Ganaga, she's a visual artist and she's a model. She got an offer, I think, simultaneously from a gallery in Cyprus and also a gallery in Germany as she was doing her show in Kiev with us, you know, because we did as much as we could to make sure that there was, you know, good publicity, professional photographs, both of the exhibition and of the launch event, good social media support. And, you know, and generally we try and look after our artists' well-being, because what I've experienced personally is, you know, I've worked with artists whose self-esteem and their kind of sense of worth and their faith in their work had been almost irreparably damaged by work with insensitive, you know, unscrupulous gallerists, dealers, curators, and artists. Well, the best artists are really the more discerning, the more introverted ones. You know, they are sensitive people, and often a vote of confidence in the form of an offer to exhibit or, you know, proper support, you know, proper curatorial support really, really goes a long way. And an artist who have exhibited with us, you know, quite often were able to get a completely new perspective on their work, because our gallery space is, it's really beautiful. It's ergonomic, it's well designed, it's quite an intimate space, but we have the kind of interior, the kind of professional lighting that showcases people's work at their best, whether it's painting, whether it's photography, whether it's sculpture, ceramics, you name it. It really, really shows it in the best light, both literally and metaphorically. So it's encouraged a lot of artists to, to apply for art residences, to apply for grants, to show their work elsewhere. So that gives me a huge, huge sense of satisfaction. I mean, cumulatively, probably as much as to honour H.R. Giger's talent posthumously.
Yeah. I mean, where do you find the artists themselves if they're really underground, very, very unknown? I mean, do you go straight to the art college, as you mentioned earlier, or is it more complicated than that?
It's an ongoing process. So,
is there like a scene that we're not aware of?
There's a vibrant scene in Ukraine, so not just in Kiev, art scene, not just in Kiev, but in other cities as well. So Lviv has many galleries. Odessa, not so many galleries, but lots of amazing artists, several good museums. So normally what happens is it's a sort of ongoing process of artists coming to you, you sort of looking out for what's there, going to different shows, going to student shows, going to workshops. There was a really cool open day of event at the Institute of Automatics. It's basically like a huge Soviet in building, which used to be a research institute, or it was used for, I'm not even sure what automatics is, but anyway, it's this huge Soviet building, and a lot of it now is being used as workshops by artists. So it was a rare opportunity to go and see, 20 artist studios all in one place. Definitely discovering some talent there, and social media as well. Honestly, you can get so much out of just scrolling through people's Instagram, Facebook. And this is, if I can give one word of advice to any aspiring artist or collector out there, is, really just try and use social media as a platform to at least explain what it is that you're doing, because the number of artists who have super obscure profile names or tags or whatever, who have some kind of weird picture that isn't their face or their artwork, and who don't even mention the fact that they're artists, I'd get 20 friend requests a day on Facebook, and many of them would be artists, but I would look at the profile and be like, I have no idea what this person is doing. So, I'm just not going to accept their request.
Go away.
Well, not go away, but you're only allowed 5,000, and Facebook is like a really?
Wow, it's a cap. That's harsh. Mm-hmm.
It is. And what you don't get to 1 million friends. Yeah, it's bullshit. You only are allowed 5,000. I was referring to this.
Yeah, you were going to do the social network. You're going to get to 1 million friends without making a few enemies.
Yeah, there we go. But
who wants a million friends, though, really? Too many friends.
There is way too many friends, arguably. Weirdly, in Ukraine, Facebook sort of doubles as... Facebook is very important. It's kind of the main professional tool not just for artists, but for people generally. You know, social media are very important. So I want to make sure that I use my 5,000 friends wisely. I think I already have like 2.5. I'm picky when it comes to
you're running out, guys. She's running out of slots.
I'm running out of slots. Well, you know, there are 52 weeks in a year, and we've been doing, since August last year, we've been doing new shows every 2 weeks, which I can tell you is exhausting.
I can imagine it is, yeah.
It is exhausting, and we're actually thinking of, you know, of slowing it down. Reason being is because there's so much great stuff. There's just so much great stuff, and I want to show as much of it as I can. And I'm in that really kind of fun, you know, I'm in that kind of really fun phase of my career where I'm still experimenting. You know, I'm still finding my feet as, you know, as a gallerist, as a curator. I can't say that I've kind of definitively amassed my portfolio. You know, that there's like half a dozen artists that I would fight tooth and nail for, that I represent exclusively hardcore. No, I'm still, you know, I'm still looking. I'm still crystallizing my portfolio as a gallerist and, you know, as an art dealer. But that does mean that, you know, I can do seemingly unrelated things like Lennon, like Giga.
Yeah, well, I mean, they are, well, yeah, but they're awesome projects though, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, you know, which is what I said. Yeah, I like to think that my work reflects my rather diverse portfolio of interests.
Would you work with Dushenko Center again? Because I say when I went there, I thought it was very impressive. And I mean, there's a lot of
now.
Well, yeah, you showed me.
Yeah, they opened a film museum, which is going to be a rotating display of exhibitions. They've got one currently on Ukrainian cinema of the 1920s. So a lot of Dzhigovyartov, a lot of Dovzhenko, a lot of kind of avant-garde experimental cinema. It's an amazing like two-floor exhibition with art installations, archival materials from like a dozen different museums, and they're building strong international links. So they actually did a Kira Muratova retrospective in London recently that you told me about.
Which I told you about, yeah, in Shoreditch.
Which you told me about. Yeah.
I only found out about it literally the last day of, like, I was really upset.
Yeah, that is sad. So, but yeah, I was there literally yesterday. And thanks for telling me about that. It was good to be au courant. But they're doing things, you know, they're part of a film festival in Turkey right now, showing the work of Ertugrul, I think. And what else? Something else going on. But yeah, of course I would. It would be a privilege. And it's such a cool space as well. It's, you know, set in what used to be a Soviet film factory. So literally a factory that made like film reel. So it's this kind of amazing like post-industrial building, which was the ideal setting for the Giga show.
So on this show, I mean, we've talked about the piano teacher. We've talked about the aesthetic syndrome. Obviously, we're going to talk about Come and See. We've talked about Head On, which you said is your date movie that you always make your dates watch.
And I'm still single, so there you go.
Well, there you go. It's their loss. Head On's a great film.
So yeah.
They just need to get over it. What can I say?
They do.
But are there any other kind of bad date movies that you're kind of really into? And what is it that attracts you to these kind of movies? Because Michael Haneke, he's not like Lars von Trier, where he has like a reputation for being really horrible to his actresses and kind of making them, like his films have been labelled as incredibly misogynistic. But they're not really, it's not an easy watch, I would say.
No, certainly not. But you expect that with Lars von Trier, don't you? Like that, there are certain directors. I mean, like Lars von Trier, like Gaspar Noé, where you enter
the void.
Prepared. Oh, I see what you did there. You sort you enter their space in expectation of being kind of shocked and titillated at the same time.
You love Gaspar Noé, don't you?
I do love him. He is.
I really love Gaspar Noé as well. He's really awesome.
Well, as you remember, I met him when he was in Kiev for the premiere of Love in 3D on the big screen. And Love is a film where he makes fun of gallery owners, of gallery people, and he actually plays an art gallerist that antagonizes the protagonist.
Oh, right.
Have you not seen Love?
I have. I got to be honest, it's probably his weakest film.
Well, I haven't seen the one with the dance troupe.
Oh, you have to see it. It's so fucking awesome. You need to listen to my review on YouTube. I reviewed it on the Lament Configuration about a year ago.
I did. I did listen. Oh, okay. And I still haven't seen it.
You've got to watch it. It's so good.
I will watch it for sure.
It's fucking great. Interestingly, I think this is a good place to kind of end this interview with you. So the best and worst representation of like a gallery owner on film.
Oh, gosh.
Have you seen The Square?
Yeah. I went to see that at the cinema with my mother and who happens to be my business partner, my co-pilot. It's a very strange film.
It was very strange.
I really enjoyed.
I found the section with Dominic West where he's giving a talk and you've got the man with Tourette's in the audience. That was incredibly awkward.
I actually thought the main character was very sympathetic. I'm not sure if that's the conclusion you meant to come to, but I feel so sorry for him. He just has such a hard time of it all.
Is it how true to life is that film?
I mean, obviously you have the Scandinavian context, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's in charge of a huge institution. Where the political responsibility and the political scrutiny is a lot higher than anything that you would do, you know, in the setting of a private art gallery, which is what I know. So very hard to tell. But I would say, you know, it touches on a lot of the themes that are being talked about in the industry.
Okay. Nocturnal Animals as well. That's got a character that's an art gallery owner.
So many people have told me that Amy Adams and I look very similar in that film.
Yeah, I kind of see what they mean.
Yeah, actually, for a while, my desktop image was a photo of Amy Adams sitting at her desk at her gallery in the film. So yeah, that film holds a lot of reflexive appeal for me.
I'm just trying to look up films about art galleries.
Are you really? Oh, well, there's a very recent one, Velvet Buzzsaw. Have you seen that yet?
Oh, Velvet Buzzsaw is a terrible film. I'd not like that film at all.
It's not a great film. It's not a great film. It's trying to do too many things at once. It's very similar to a film called Boogie Woogie, which...
Is that really the name of a film? That's a terrible name.
So, yeah, it's a film
Boogie
called...
Boogie Woogie.
It's a film called Boogie Woogie. Yeah, it's a British black comedy. Directed by Duncan Ward. So it's from 2009, which is exactly 10 years ago. And it's got an all-star cast, which includes a very creepy Stellan Skarsgård, Gillian Anderson, Joanna Lumley.
Right, okay.
Who else? Heather Graham, Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee.
He's amazing in it. He's amazing. So,
oh, he's amazing in everything. He's even amazing in like shit films like The Howling 2 and stuff like that.
He lends it such gravitas. It's basically, the film is named after a Piet Mondrian painting, Victory Boogie Woogie, and Christopher Lee is this like 80 or 90 or 100 year old collector.
Oh god.
Who is wheelchair bound, and he won't let go of the Mondrian, even though that him and his wife and his butler, whom the wife is having an affair with, are completely impoverished. So he won't let go of this painting. And, you know, the whole film is about all the, you know, the cast and crude of the art world, from, you know, the level of, from artists who are trying to break through to top dog dealers to, you know, blue chip collectors. It's got it all. And it's sort of, you know, it's that also is a film that is sort of trying to do too many things at once. So it's trying to take you on this underground tour of the art world, while also entertaining you and, you know, retaining kind of plots and twists, but it's also trying to be trendy. And I think that is what Velvet Buzzsaw is also doing. It's got too many contemporary references that are not going to age very well. You know, everyone is dressed with too much purpose. I mean, everyone is
that. Yeah. Hang on, how is that a criticism? Just, I'm not saying I disagree with you, but what do you mean by that?
It's just, you know, it doesn't really feel like a film about real people. It's very hard to suspend your disbelief. It sort of reads like a who's who of the art world. Like, everyone's an archetype,
right?
You know, it's sort of like going through a tarot deck or something, where you've got these highly stylized, very ornate, very beautiful, very suggestive, you know, archetypal images. You know, no one is the fool or the moon or whatever. You know, we are all a combination.
When you are the moon.
Exactly. It's a Mighty Boosh reference, you kids. Look it up.
The only thing I liked about Velvet Buzzsaw is John Malkovich, because John Malkovich is awesome in everything he's in. I was going to say,
so he, basically, John Malkovich is the Christopher Lee of this film.
He really is. He's awesome.
He really is. He is absolutely amazing.
I love John Malkovich since Burn After Reading. I'm going to write my memoir.
My memoir.
Memoir.
He is incredible. Burn After Reading is actually, probably controversially, I think my second most favourite Coen Brothers film.
Ha! He thinks I'm driving a Schwim. I just love John Malkovich in that film. He just says fuck, like, a lot. And he just, like, just gets so angry at just really stupid people. It's just amazing.
He's very likeable in that film. Like, I'm rooting for him.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think J.K. Simmons as well. I think the kind of that interplay of them. Because in many ways, they are both kind of antagonistic actors.
And Tilda Swinton as well. Tilda Swinton's great in Burn After Reading. You're not talking to one of your shithole buddies.
Is Tilda Swinton your spirit animal?
You get these people who are really massively into Tilda Swinton,
mm-hmm.
like in that sort of very odd way. I can't say that I am. I do appreciate a lot of work that she's in fairness.
Yeah, yeah. I love Young Adam.
Yes, we saw that together, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. I love her in that film.
I like I Am Love by Luca Guadagnino. That's a great film.
I haven't seen that. I love her in Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yeah, that's a good film. It's not my favourite Jarmusch film, but it's very good.
It's probably my favourite Jarmusch film. I actually made a list of my top 40 favorite films recently. And there are horror films on the list. But I think there are films that don't classify as horror films, which also have a very dark, brooding, gloomy aesthetic.
Yeah, I would say Only Lovers Left Alive kind of counts in
that. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the question is that a horror film, or what is that a film about?
I wouldn't say it's a horror film. Its purpose isn't really to scare people. Like, it isn't unnerving or anything like that. It doesn't really have the atmosphere of, like, a horror film. Even the way that something like the Nosferatu remake, the Herzog Nosferatu remake.
Which is also on my list.
Yes, it was indeed. Where that has like an atmosphere of like a, well, it's evoking kind of the German expressionist kind of atmosphere that something like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari or the original Nosferatu had. Whereas something like Only Lovers Left Alive, it's more like a character drama, and they happen to be vampires.
Isn't that a love song to Detroit? A love poem to Detroit. And to music.
Yes, there's a lot of good music in that film.
I have the soundtrack on vinyl. Also, I went to see Josef van Fissum play his lute when he was in Kiev.
Okay. Not really sure how to respond to that. Okay.
Well, to be honest, I feel like once you've seen and heard him do it once, you've ticked that sexy box. I had a friend of mine visiting from the Netherlands, Leilani, and I wanted to surprise her with a pair of Josef van Fissum tickets. And she arrived, and I think it was like our first evening in Kiev, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm taking you to see Josef van Fissum. And she just went, oh man, I've already seen him. And I'm like, so you get to enjoy him all over again. And literally, like, first two or three tracks, and I was like, okay, I get it. My bad.
Okay, so the film that I've brought Miroslava on the show today to talk about is Come and See by Lyom Klimov. A great film that I'm sure you will agree.
I agree.
Cool.
No, I'm just, you know, even you mentioning it is just sort of transporting me back to the, John Rathel called it in his article on the film titled Excursion to Hell, called it an apocalypse firmly rooted in the real. So yeah, I was back in Nazi occupied Belarus of 1943 for a second there.
There's a very interesting quote online that I'm going to nick from the Wikipedia article on Come and See that I thought was incredible, and I can't believe someone's actually said this. I don't know if you've seen this before, but it was in Empire magazine, and it said that here we go. So Lyom Klimov's seriously influential, deeply unsettling Belarusian opus, No Film, Not Apocalypse Now, Not Full Metal Jacket, spells out the dehumanizing impact of conflict more vividly or ferociously. An impressionist masterpiece and possibly the worst date movie ever.
Oh, shebang.
So there you go. So even in...
We've hit bullseye.
Empire knew that it's a very, very bad date movie. And as we go through the show, I'm sure you will all agree. But I don't want to go into Come and See right away. What I wanted to do is because my favourite type of war movie is the Soviet war movie. So this is a very, very specific type of movie that came out mostly in sort of the late 50s, early 60s, the 70s, and then Come and See is obviously in the 80s. So what I wanted to do is, before we talk about Come and See itself, I want to kind of give some kind of context to kind of where Come and See is in kind of the history and the evolution of the Soviet war movie. So what I wanted to ask you, Miro, first of all, is in the Soviet Union at the time, what you had was called the Great Patriotic War. So this is what to us in the West is World War II, but it's not called World War II where you are.
But the Great Patriotic War was the name given to the war by Soviet ideologists to reflect the colossal sacrifice that the Soviet troops, but also the Soviet population endured during the war, during the Nazi occupation. I mean, come and see, shows us up close some of the atrocities that Soviet civilians endured, and the very heavy losses. I mean, it's officially a figure of 20 million was given during the Soviet era to denote both civilian and military casualties. But now it's estimated that it's as high as 26 to 29 million. And that's, a lot of people. And also, Soviet ideology rested essentially on two great historic narratives or myths. The first one was the myth of the Russian Revolution as a mass popular revolution rather than a coup, which it was. The second one was that of the heroic Soviet victory against the Nazi aggressor, mostly on the Eastern Front, but it tended to ignore the input of the Allies, as well as kind of edit the brutal reality of war, kind of focusing on heroism rather than on on some of the atrocities that were committed, even by Soviet authorities against their own returning prisoners of war, for instance.
That's actually quite interesting, because I just had a thought, think about it when you said that. And yeah, you're right. They don't really refer to the war as a whole. It's only what was going on the Eastern Front at the time. It's almost like the rest of Europe didn't really matter.
Well, I think it's natural for every country to have, to focus historically on its own participation. But yeah, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Ukraine, for instance, so what is now geographically independent Ukraine then would have been part of as many as four different countries, with Ukrainians fighting at different parts during the Second World War, not just as part of the Soviet effort within the Great Patriotic War. So we're kind of moving towards a more inclusive narrative in Ukraine. In Russia, obviously, it's still very much about the Great Patriotic War. And there are many monuments. There are many sort of ceremonial aspects to kind of honoring the Soviet war dead, honoring, the Soviet civilian casualties as well.
Yeah, which moves into kind of the actual films themselves. So
absolutely.
In the Stalin era, we have, well, obviously the Eisenstein films, which are not about World War II, but he made obviously a couple of war films, as Alexander Nevsky and obviously Battleship Potemkin. So, but they are propaganda films, most definitely, but they are looked on much more fondly than other kind of war movies of the Stalin era, which are literally propaganda films, but have... well, which are deemed as having no artistic merit to speak of, because most of them, I've got to be honest, I haven't actually heard of any of them. That's sort of how kind of little fanfare they have, really, so to speak.
That's true. I think the films that have artistic merit today, that are perceived as having artistic merit today, tend to come after the death of Stalin in 1953. So, for instance, we have The Cranes Are Flying from 1957. Yeah, essentially a melodrama set during the Second World War. Ballad of a Soldier in 1959, for instance, even though that refers to, that's not primarily a war film. That's also kind of focuses more on a story of friendship. So films that have a more personal narrative at the heart and with less focus on kind of the overview.
Yeah, so the only film that I thought had any merit, I don't know, if it's not necessarily about World War II, because it was made before World War II, but it was interestingly, because it's by Alexander Dushenko, is Arsenal,
which is
about World War
I. You saw that
War
recently.
Yes,
you?
I did. I watched that for this show. I was doing my research.
of course.
Which, yeah, actually has more war footage in it than I think most of the films of the period that you're talking about in the Khrushchev era. So, but again, it's more like you said, and this is the interesting thing about all these films, is I don't know if it's due to budgetary reasons or if it's just the times they were made or because of Soviet censorship or what have you, but it's not necessarily, you're right, they're not necessarily about the actual soldiers on the front line fighting against the Nazis. They're about the soldiers, or they're people who know soldiers, and it's about the effects back home, so to speak. And in terms of The Cranes Are Flying, you're right, it's a melodrama. It's not, that's obviously one of the characters involved is a soldier, but it's more about his, you know, girlfriend who he wants to marry, and that she's, you know, stuck at home while he's on the front line. They can't talk to each other, or they try and talk to each other, but their communications don't get to each other, and there's this guy who she's living with who really likes her, and things like
that. Who rapes her.
Well, there you go. So, yeah.
I'm sorry, was that a euphemism? Really likes her.
It's been a while since I've seen that film, so I think I just forgot. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. You've got Ballad of a Soldier, which, you know, it's about a soldier, admittedly, hence why it's got that name. But it's about a soldier who's on his way home from battle, and kind of all different things that happen to him. And there's another film from this period by Sergei Bondarchuk called Fate of a Man, which I think is also called Destiny of a Man. I don't know if that's a literal kind of translation, but again, it's about someone who is affected by the war because he's lost his wife and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think compared to a lot of other countries, I think every national cinema has its different sort of strata of war movies, but in Soviet cinema, war movies continued to be a genre, you know, well into the glasnost years. And Come and See is an example of a late Soviet movie that is a lot more expressionistic, a lot more experimental in its visual language, and a lot more controversial in the content that it shows and the sort of interpretation that it offers of the events that occurred. The Soviet war film is one of the genres alongside the melodrama, the action film, the production film, the comedy film. It's there. It's there in the 50s, as we've discussed. It's there in the 60s. It's there in the 70s. It's there in the 80s. It's something that just never goes away. And a lot of that is for propaganda purposes, you know, keeping the Soviet sacrifice very much in the foreground of people's minds to show that, oh no, actually, no, they do need the state to defeat the sort of danger that comes from a hostile regime. I mean, obviously, you know, after the Second World War, you know, we had the Cold War. The ideological enemy shifted from Nazi Germany to...
Is that a directive from above? Because, I mean, I would say all these films, that they're obviously from the Soviet point of view. They're not as kind of blatantly propaganda films as the Stalinist films.
Oh, no, sure. There was, you know, there was a lot of room for creative expression.
Could they not get these films made, is kind of what I'm saying, unless they had that view?
No, because you couldn't get access to equipment or to funding. You had to be a member of the National Union of Filmmakers. You had to be an official registered director. Your script had to be approved. Your film had to be approved. I mean, there are cases of films being made and not, you know, and being left for years on the censored shelf because they didn't, you know, conform to directives from above. And a lot of that was discretionary. A lot of that came from Soviet officials who were far from the creative process. And there was always this battle between sort of the creative arm and the official arm, so to speak. But of course, you know, when you had someone like Yelena Klimov, who came very, very high up the Soviet film production food chain, didn't he?
He did in the end, yeah.
Mm.
After Come and See came out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, interesting you mentioned sort of directors who had trouble with the Soviet censors. Obviously, at this time, the I suppose one of, I guess, the top three most well-known Soviet war movies is Ivan's Childhood by Andrei Tarkovsky, his first film. And a film very similar to Come and See in a lot of ways because the main character is a child. And interestingly, in this period, it's the only film that kind of takes place while the war's still going on. And it's kind of on the front line, although you don't get any scenes of kind of soldiers fighting each other or anything like that. It is set during wartime. It's still going on. And it's very different in that it's very poetic and it's very lyrical in that sense. You know, it's very, let's say, very early Tarkovsky. You hadn't found his signature style yet. But it's very different. It's way less melodramatic, I guess, than the other films at this time. And yeah, so very interesting counterpoint to Come and See.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Come and See has been compared to Ivan's Childhood quite a lot. Some say he pays homage to Tarkovsky in Come and See.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm going to talk about that when we come to talk about the film itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you get the 70s period, which is under Brezhnev. And the difference now, and again, I don't know if this is just because censorship rules have changed or if it's just a more modern time or if the budgets were higher. But at this point, you get more films that are actually about soldiers on the front line during the war. So in the sort of early to mid 70s, you've got films like Trial on the Road by Alexei Kerman, The Dawn's Here Are Quiet, which is by Stanislav Rossetatsky. They Fought for Their Motherland by Sergei Bondarchuk again. He's a director of War and Peace. That one is, I haven't actually seen it, but it's a lot more kind of a typical war movie, like you would probably get in America, where it's literally sort of a group of soldiers on the front line, actual battle scenes. It's kind of very kind of similar to something like Saving Private Ryan in that regard. Also, another film I haven't actually seen, but I heard about, because I believe it's a Ukrainian film, it's called Only Old Men Are Going to Battle by Leonid Bykov.
Yeah, it's a good one. A lot more lighthearted.
Yeah, and also at this time, and this ties in a lot to Come and See, is The Ascent by Larissa Shapitko. Larissa Shapitko was the late wife of Yelena Klimov, which is probably my second favourite Soviet war movie of this period. And again, it's very, very kind of psychological, and it's, I suppose, along with Come and See and probably Apocalypse Now, it's probably one of the only war movies that's not literally about kind of soldiers fighting and kind of their camaraderie and stuff like that. It's actually about deep psychological, almost religious kind of symbolism.
I think we could probably do a whole separate podcast about The Ascent. I'm a huge fan of the film.
Yes, it's my favourite film, our directed movie of all time. It's an amazing film.
It is.
And just bring it up to the present day. I mean, I'm shocked at the sheer number of kind of war movies that still get made, even in Russia or the former Soviet states today.
Absolutely.
Some that I've looked up, some of which I've seen a little bit of, and they're different parts of the former Soviet Union. So you've got a film called Fortress of War by Alexander Kott, which I saw was all right. It's very kind of very typical sort of modern kind of war movie. That's a co-Russian Belarusian production. And then you've got a film called In the Fog by Sergei Loznitsa, who's a Ukrainian director. But the film itself, similar to The Ascent, is also based on a story by Vasil Bykov, which is again a lot more about kind of soul, it's a lot more deeply kind of psychological. And that's a co-production of various different countries, including Belarus and Russia. And on the other end of the scale, you've got stuff like Stalingrad by Fedor Bondarchuk.
Yeah, I was going to refer to that, which has, you know, some very very contemporary visuals. I mean, a lot of CGI. It's sort of shot in a kind of very trendy way, almost in the style of a high budget music video.
Yeah, I've heard it's shot very similar to like 300. Lots of slow mo.
Yeah, a lot of it, very stylized.
Very, very heavily stylized. Yeah, I'm not sure I would probably enjoy that one. I also saw a film, it was on Amazon Prime. It's from a very similar time period again. It's called Battle for Sevastopol, which is a co-Russian-Ukrainian production. I guess almost like the Soviet kind of counterpoint to American Sniper. I guess is the best way to describe that one.
Well, it's significant that, you know, we have a lot of these contemporary Russian-Belarusian co-productions kind of almost bolstering the more traditional Soviet view of the Second World War, where a lot of the time the heroism of the Soviet soldiers goes unchallenged. There's very little, there are very few kind of moral grey areas. You asked why it was that in the 70s Soviet war movies take on a more kind of action focus. It's probably because there is a need to show the events of the war to a younger generation who themselves did not go to war.
Yeah, that's very true. I suppose by that point it's at least 25 years sort of after the events.
Yeah. And obviously going to the cinema was very popular amongst Soviet citizens. People would, there were quite a few films coming out all the time. And in practice, people would go and see everything that was showing. So this was a very important kind of bonding experience for families. And so, you know, you would have these multiple generations going to see war movies together, and quite often that would generate, you know, a discussion or reminiscences, or so it was both a reassuring but also kind of an ideologically motivated choice of the Soviet state to fund as many war movies as they did. At any one time, you would have at least one new war film playing, but quite often you would have several.
That's still the case now, because I've noticed there's films even this year that have been released in Russia that are about World War II. You'd think they would run out of kind of events in World War II to kind of make films about. I mean, is this similar to the Stalin era, where you think that Putin is kind of, I don't know, heading up sort of, it's like propaganda?
I would really caution you against making such, you know, historic comparisons. I think it's symptomatic of many countries that spent, you know, decades in isolation from the world. In Ukraine, there is an upsurge of, you know, national, I mean, I don't want to say nationalistic, but let's say cinema that is funded by the state, that is designed to instill national pride.
I would say that's what movies like this are aimed to do. I guess that's why you would make a war movie. That's why something like Saving Private Ryan exists.
There's a very curious film that is coming out in Ukraine soon. It's called X, and it's very odd. I saw a trailer for it. It is basically like, I think it's modeled on Peaky Blinders. It's a very strange thing. It's basically, I think it's set in the 1910s or 1920s, and it's basically set in Western Ukraine, and it's a gang of Western Ukrainian nationalists that are robbing banks in order to raise money for Ukraine's war of independence against the Poles.
Right.
So it's interesting to see the kind of the focus shift from Russians to Poles, because obviously, you know, another
those horrible another Poles.
Former empire. But you saw this in Polish cinema in the early 2000s, and actually you see that even now with kind of added EU funding and generally bigger budgets. There was a lot of focus on producing films which raised a generation of proud Poles, you know. And I saw a film called, I believe it's called Warsaw, and it was about the Battle for Warsaw, a Polish film, which I actually saw in 3D, believe it or not.
Oh, same and style, it had, Brad.
Yeah, yeah. And it was very much like that, you know, very crisp, very modern, kind of flawless editing, but absolutely no nuance. You know, everyone was either very bad
or very good.
You sort of had, there was this scene, I remember literally nothing of the film except a general impression. And there was a scene where a Polish, like a priest on the front line, stands against an armada of tanks brandishing a crucifix, and you sort of see, you know, you see his fist kind of trying to, I don't know what he's trying to do, but he's basically raising a cross to the sky as he's been crushed by a tank. You know, it's a very different flavor to something like Come and See, which uses quite a range of visual means to convey the horror of war, but none of them are as in your face as that.
Yeah, yeah, we're not in kind of the moral complexity of something like The Ascent. No. Or Come and See.
Not at all.
No, and that brings us very, very nicely, in fact, to the film that we're here to talk about in great detail today, which is Come and See. If you've not listened to one of these shows before, first of all, why haven't you? These are awesome. I'm joking. The thing I kind of want to try and say at the start of all these shows is, if you have never seen Come and See before, we're going to be talking about the film in some great detail, so there's going to be many spoilers. Also, there may be some upsetting content in there. It's a very harrowing film in a lot of ways, as we're going to discuss. So you may be upset. But then again, if you're likely to be easily upset, why are you listening to a show called Worst Date Movies Ever? So that's on you, I'm afraid. In terms of kind of where Come and See is in the evolution, what I was going to say, and this kind of ties into all the previous sort of 15 or 20 minutes, is to me it feels like a combination of the movies from the late 50s and Ivan's childhood. If we ignore Ivan's childhood, because that's kind of like a separate thing, what I find about the films from the 50s is it's about a series of characters and the war is going on and they are affected by the war. They are not directly affecting what's going on in the film, they are reacting to it. And whereas the 70s sort of Soviet war movies are about soldiers and they're on the front line, they are fighting the Nazis, and it's about how they interact with other soldiers, and there's all this stuff going on the front line. So Come and See, to me, is a combination of the two, because the main character is very, very much throughout the film affected by the events around him. He is not really, no, he has no effect on what's going on. He just is a bystander in a lot of ways to what is happening, but yet it is literally taking place on the front line. There are Belarusian soldiers, there are German soldiers and things like that. So that's kind of how I think it ties in. It's kind of a mixture of the two.
I would tend to agree with you. A lot of the horror comes from the fact that the protagonist, Flora, a village boy, is paralyzed with fear, with the inability to act, you know, to do anything to counter what he is witnessing.
Yes, so Ellen Klimov, he's the director of this film and the co-writer. This is by far his most well-known film. His other I guess, fairly well-known film is a film called Welcome or No Trespassing, which is very, very different, as this a comedy satire, which is set in a summer camp, believe it or not. So that is sort of positively kind of fun and games compared to this film. The story of the film is based on a short story, which is called I Am From the Fiery Village, which is written by three people, but mainly who we're going to concentrate on is Alice Adamovich, who is the co-writer of Come and See. And the story is based on his observations and his experiences during World War II. Because this section of the war, one of the things that he said about this film is it's the most realistic, it's the most true to life, because it's based on things that actually happened. If anything, as horrific as a lot of the things are, there are things that happen in real life that are worse they could not possibly include in the film, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Interesting point on the title of the film. So in English, the film is called Come and See. Now, in Belarusian, the direct translation is Come and See. But in Russian, apparently it has a different title, that, as you have told me before.
So basically, the title is taken from a passage in the Apocalypse of St. John, where, so let me just read out.
Yeah, sure.
So it's chapter 6, verses 7 to 8. And it's an invitation to look upon the destruction caused by the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And when he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, "Come and see." And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. And power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword, and with hunger, and with death, and with the beasts of the earth. So it's literally an apocalyptic reference.
Yeah, it's very evocative, and it's very kind of true to what happens in the film.
But
interestingly, it's not what Klimov actually wanted to call the film initially. He apparently, well, according to him in an interview that I saw earlier today, he originally wanted to call the film Kill Hitler, which
refers to the final scene of the film.
Yeah, so it refers to the most famous scene in the film, which is not literally right at the end of the film, but is basically right near the end of the film, where the main character effectively kills Hitler over and over and over and over again. It's not literally, I mean, you could take the title as incredibly kind of reductionist, as, oh, kill Hitler, Hitler's well bad in it. But no, that's not actually what the title means. But apparently the censors wouldn't allow him to call the film that, because they didn't think it should refer to Hitler as literally as it does. So hence why the film is called Come and See.
Well, if I remember correctly, what happens is, so Flora is holding a rifle and he's near a puddle where there is a photograph of Hitler with some Belarusian writing on it. So these were kind of propaganda materials that were distributed around all the occupied territories. And he's shooting at the portrait. And as he is shooting at the photograph of Hitler, we are shown documentary footage, so actual historical footage, which is built into the film. And it's been shown in reverse. So we basically see Hitler's rise to power and to war in reverse all the way back until we see a photo of Hitler as a child. And it is then that Flora is unable to shoot at it again when he sees that Hitler too was a child many, many years ago, just like he was until recently.
Yeah,
and he stops.
Yeah.
And he doesn't shoot. And that sort of shows that humanity in him has not been completely erased.
No, although, by the end of the film, you wouldn't really blame him. But yes, the point is that at one point Hitler was a child, and at some point, maybe, like, the things like this could have happened to him to end up in the situation where he is. So maybe Floria could end up being the new Hitler at some point. you know, if he carries on as he goes. Cool. So, so Miro, so what is the story of Come and See?
So Come and See shows us a day in the life of Flora, or which is short for Florian, a Belarusian village boy in the midst of a Nazi reprisal operation against the civilian population. So what Nazi reprisals were, for instance, if one of the partisans or freedom fighters kills a Nazi soldier or Nazi officer, God forbid, an SS battalion would go into that village and basically burn the whole village to the ground to set an example that the Nazi occupation was, you know, was undisputed, was untouchable. And so this boy, he leaves his mother and his younger siblings to join the partisans in the forest, which he thinks will be an exciting adventure. His mother begs him not to go. He leaves. In that time, the Nazis come, completely slaughter everyone. But he sort of enjoys a brief moment of respite when he meets a beautiful girl who's in love with the commander of the partisan group, Glasha. And there's a kind of very strange scene, which I think the scene where it's raining in the forest and they're sort of running around, like shouting like mad, it just have a kind of, it's like an unsettled Tarkovsky, wouldn't you say? It's like a mad Tarkovsky.
Yeah, that scene is definitely very, very Tarkovsky influenced, or is very, very similar to something that he would do, because of the way it's done, because you've got, it suddenly rains and then you've got the birds. Now, one of the things I was going to say is that birds appear quite a lot in this film. There's a lot of bird related imagery. So you've got, I believe it's a heron that appears in the scene you're talking about. The scene where Floria goes back to his mother's house and, you know, his mother and his sisters aren't there, and then he looks down a well. On the well is a bird. There's bird sound on the score during a lot of the more harrowing scenes. It's part of the layers of sound that take place. And there's a couple of other scenes where birds appear, or there is sort of, they appear in the film a few different places. It's kind of almost very Terrence Malick-esque.
Okay, that's interesting. That's honestly not something that I picked up on.
I'm sure there is some kind of visual symbolism there. I'm not good with symbolism normally, but it was too kind of, I don't know, it's kind of too blatant not to notice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it is set in the country, so there's a lot of kind of folk customs and superstitions to do with birds, like if you hear this bird sing, it means that, etc. So it's quite possible. I didn't read the story that this is based on, but it may well be that that's a trope in the story as well.
They're very evocative images nonetheless, though.
Absolutely. One of the key scenes in the film is obviously when practically the remaining population of the village is herded into a barn, which is set on fire by the Nazis. And I think that is definitely a scene that Spielberg drew on.
Yeah, that's definitely drawn on when he mentioned this list, because there's a scene that's practically very, very similar to it. It's not involved fire, but it does involve like Jews being herded and into a single building.
Yeah,
I believe they use it in something very similar in Son of Saul as well, which is a Hungarian war film that came out a couple of years ago. Again, it's not involving sort of people being set on fire; it's more people being gassed. But again, it's sort of the scene of kind of groups of sort of men, women, and children all being put in a single location, and you can really feel the claustrophobia and the sense of what the fuck is going to happen, and we're scared for our lives type thing.
Well, this is something that happened again and again, hundreds, even thousands of times, all across the occupied territories. So yeah, although this is showing, you know, one case, the understanding is that this was happening not just once, but many, many times. There's also an episode in The Reader, both the film and the book, the Schilderdink book that it was based on, where Kate Winslet's character, he was a guard in a concentration camp, basically does the same to a group of Jewish prisoners, which is then what she is tried for. So it's something that happened again and again.
One of the things, that's immediately obvious, so the start of the film. So I really like sort of the way the film looks. So one of the things that I found really awesome about the film is, I believe about 95% of the film is set outside. So kind of prominent colours in the film are like green and brown. And so, yeah, very earthy, very natural colours. And which again sort of makes it stand out, because I think a lot of films, they kind of have to take place inside because they've set up sets, or because maybe it's easier to shoot.
Wow. And also most Soviet war films are black and white, aren't they?
Mm. Whereas this one's in colour, which is very interesting.
1985, so it's a lot later. Which is, it's not just in the color, it's not just the color of it. It's also the way that it's edited.
The editing in this is awesome. And I love the camera work. So the camera work is very similarly to The Ascent by Larisa Shapitko. Mm. It involves a lot of face close-ups. So particularly, I think my second favorite, or possibly even my favorite section of the film, is between Floria and Glasha, where mm-hmm. most of it is their faces are in the center of the frame and they're basically looking at the camera while they're talking to each other. That's sort of a very hypnotic scene where you've got them basically staring at each other, talking to each other, and they have these very strange conversations that don't really make sense if you were taking them literally. But they kind of feed into this sort of hypnotic, kind of strange, I guess Tarkovsky-like kind of feel that those sections are going for. I thought, because I've actually seen this film about four or five times now, and there's sort of little things that you kind of notice when you're kind of watching the film. In a way, I felt that, like, Glasha, she is a real person. It's like she is there, but she's almost got this, like, supernatural presence. Because when she first appears in the film, she appears kind of almost like far away, and no one acknowledges her apart from the leader of the partisans and Floria. Everyone else doesn't really pay any attention to her, as if she's like a ghost or a spirit.
Yeah, that's true. I think also her role in this is to show that Floria experiences the entire spectrum of human emotions in the space of 24 hours, because he falls in love, he's fascinated. You know, she mocks him. She is beautiful. She is older than him. She's sort of graceful. She's also in love with basically the alpha male of the Belarusian partisan resistance.
It's always the way it goes, isn't it?
Absolutely. So he watches her with fascination and trepidation, and it is through his eyes that we see everything that we see. So if we compare the sort of heightened emotional state in which we are shown the first meeting with Glasha, to the sheer detachment and the sheer kind of emotional, it's not even apathy, it's almost the inadequacy of emotion in the scene where the peasants are burnt in a barn. It shows us that he has exhausted he's exhausted everything, you know, all his feelings.
Yeah, and as well, around this time, what I really like in those scenes is kind of the dreamlike feel of them. So you mentioned, obviously, they're very Tarkovsky-like. It's got that very, very poetic, almost surreal feel that a lot of Tarkovsky's films have. So I'm particularly thinking of, like, Nostalgia, or even, like, the end of Stalker, for example, and things like that. It kind of just reminded me of that, to me.
And a lot of that is a scene that kind of, the edge is blurred between the natural world and the human world.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm. Solaris as well is another example.
Yeah, most of Tarkovsky's films, in fact, and Mirror. I mean, there's scenes in Mirror that are, like, amazingly like that. Like the scene where like a shed that's burning in the distance, or where the water is evaporating and you kind of see it happen. It's like, what's it called, where real life is sped up. I assume that's how he did it. Mm. But yeah, like, scenes like that, just so they're not like... It's not like CGI kind of weird stuff. It's the real world, but it's used in like a lyrical kind of way. It's very, very awesome.
Yeah, it's visual poetry. It's basically exactly. Something which...
That's what I was thinking of. That's why you're here. You're here to carry me, kind of remember things like that, little terms that I can never remember.
I'm here to pepper your hard work and research with a few flourishes here.
Exactly,
and there.
Exactly. You're here to carry me on this show. Also, I mean, other bird things that I've seen in my notes, near the beginning of the film, where Floria is basically being taken away by the two partisans, and his mother's sort of trying to tell them, why are you doing this, like, he's just a young boy. There are birds in the house pecking at crumbs on the floor, and when Floria goes into the forest, he accidentally steps on some bird eggs as well, so that's more kind of bird imagery in there. Weirdly, compared to a lot of other war films, apart from this partisan leader, and there's another kind of partisan character who's fairly prominent in the middle of the film, all the soldiers aren't really kind of given any kind of center stage, which kind of, I guess, ties into kind of that they're not really the center of the story. It's Floria's story, so it's set during the war, but it's about the war's effect on him. That's kind of the central story. And yeah, I found that quite interesting compared to something like The Dawns Here Are Quiet or Trial on the Road, or, well, pretty much any kind of war film where generally you're on the front line, you've got your leader, and you've got probably a second in command, and you've got all the privates and stuff like that, and it's kind of them kind of brothers in arms. It's sort of very, very atypical.
If you're referring to The Dawns Are Quiet here.
Okay. Brothers and sisters in arms. It's not really that kind of film. The partisans, even the Nazis, for the most part, they're very kind of dehumanized, which I thought was different.
Also, the heightened aestheticism of the way the SS battalion is shown. You know, like, you've got the female Nazi officer eating lobster.
Yes.
You know, she's and the sort of meticulous detail that is shown. You know, you've got the Nazi officer with
it's a loris.
He's got a pet loris, yeah, and just kind of just sheer indulgence, you know, the sheer kind of decadence of it. You know, he's in the middle of a Belarusian forest with this exotic pet, you know, like, there's no function to it, so he's comfortable enough to be petting this sort of outlandish creature. The cruelty of it, the coldness of their expressions.
Yeah, I suppose kind of going to that section of the film, I mean, that's kind of the center point of the film, because that whole section takes about half an hour, but it doesn't feel like half an hour at all.
It's so tense.
Yeah, it's this montage of images. There isn't really any dialogue. It's mostly shouting, and you've got dogs barking, and you've got the radio, which I think really adds a lot, because I've got to say, the sound design in this film is absolutely amazing. So scenes like that, and another scene that I'm going to talk about in a minute, which is the scene in the mud bog, where you've got the sound of the score itself, and then, and so in this scene, for example, you've got all the human voices, and then you've got animal kind of sounds which are on top, which are non-diegetic for the most part, and then you have the classical music as well on top of that. So what you have is you have this very disorientating effect of this, yeah, just this wall of sound during a lot of these, and it works so well. It's you know, it's just the great use of music, and just in the film, it's just it's absolutely amazing.
It is, and Mozart's Lacrimosa, Mozart's Requiem. In the scene where Flora is shooting a photograph of Hitler, it's very powerful. I mean, the kind of the choral chorus is such a it's a device that is used in so many films. You know, when the choirs, you know, when you have the choirs just suddenly just coming in, but in this film, it's so powerful.
Yeah, and as you've mentioned during this scene, is a scene where you've got the villagers and they're all rounded up and thrown into this building to be set on fire. And so apparently in real life, sometimes what they would do is they would say, okay, the men have to stay and the children are allowed to leave. But in this case, what they said is like the men are allowed to leave and the women and children have to stay. And I think a man tries to leave and he gets shot in the window. And Floria is interestingly allowed to leave. He manages to leave without getting shot, which I thought was quite interesting. And there's a woman who tries to escape, but then she gets captured and taken away and is presumably raped, although that takes place off screen. And she appears later on. It's her and she's got the blood down her legs and she looks like she's in almost like a catatonic state. This is after the Nazis have gone. Yeah, it's almost like the effect of almost like a circus coming into town. It's got that kind of effect. It's very, very disorientating. We've got all these people. And yeah, it's I almost feel like I can't really do it justice, even if I talked about this for like 30 minutes or an hour, just about this one section. Just the way it's done is just unbelievable. But as horrifying as it is, one thing I would say is that it's not gratuitous. Like, you have this building being set on fire, and we know that in the story, obviously, there are all these people in the building, but it's not like you literally see them on fire. This is not, you know, SS experiment camp or a film like that where you literally would see people burn, and you don't see, you know, there are women taken away and clearly they are being raped by multiple kind of Nazi soldiers, but you don't see it, but that's clearly what's happening.
Yeah, that's it's very, it is that there is a sense of a frenetic sense of almost like a carnival of death, is the expression that, you know, you sometimes see in the literature.
Also during the film, one thing that I really like, and it comes up about four or five times, is there's a plane that flies overhead at different points during the film. And it literally happens in like the first 2 minutes of the film. And when that happens, there's this sort of drone sound on the score, and that comes in, I think, during this section as well, on top of the million other things that are going on. And yeah, it has a really awesome effect.
So according to Wikipedia, it's a Focke Wulf FW189 Uhu. It's a twin engine, twin boom, three seat tactical reconnaissance and army corporation aircraft, which was flying above all the time when they were shooting the film, because he wanted that to be part of the Dianetic sound.
Yeah, it works really well. It works really well, definitely. And it also comes in to my second favourite part of the film, an incredibly intense section of the film, which is the scene that I kind of mentioned already, where Flory's gone back to his mother's house. Mother and his sisters aren't there. There's flies everywhere. You can hear flies really, really prominently on the soundtrack. And there's like dead dolls on the floor. Broken dolls, I should say. Dead dolls. They were alive. And the Nazis shot them, the bastards. No. And he, whether he knows, but he doesn't know, in inverted commas, or he just suspects, but he's just, you know, in denial about what's going on. He just assumes, well, my family, they've gone to an island, and then they him and Glasha run off, and then Glasha turns around, sees all these dead bodies on the edge of side of his house, or maybe another house, it's not really clear. And then it gets to the scene where they go through the mud bog, which is very similar to a scene in The Doors Here Are Quiet.
Oh god, yeah, that seriously, that scene, I remember seeing it on TV as a child. It absolutely horrified me. The sort of scene where a female soldier is walking through a woodland bog, and it slowly sucks her in. I just thought that was just the worst thing ever. I used to have nightmares about it. Well, apparently the final episode, or actually was the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones, the scene where sort of Arya wanders through a completely destroyed King's Landing has been said to be an allusion to Come and See.
Oh, there you go.
In the framing and in her expression, and even in the sort of makeup that they use on her and the tone. Yeah, it's said to be referring to this.
So either the writer or the director would have seen this film and kind of gone, let's use that. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just after the scene in the mud bog, there's another very, very harrowing scene which takes place where Floria and Glasha have found the other villagers. And I really like this scene. It does remind me of, and I'm going to invoke this again, it does involve, kind of remind me almost of like the way that the villagers are almost chanting, because I think it's mostly women. I assume all the men would be fighting, so it's mostly the women of the village.
I think you refer to it as shamanic scene.
Yeah, it's very shamanic, almost tribal-like. So there's a scene in Cannibal Holocaust in the first, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes of the film, where the tribe are kind of all sat around, and Dr. Monroe, Professor Monroe, rather, is basically recording them kind of chanting. It's this tribal ceremony. It's not, you know, it's not happy. It's a drone. It's a droning kind of cacophony of noise.
Well, it's a ceremony that's it's largely improvised, isn't it? And it's born out of a kind of collective despair. So these terrified villagers make an effigy of Hitler out of mud that they put onto a human skull dressed in a Nazi soldier's uniform. So you can only imagine where that came from. Probably a dead Nazi soldier.
I would imagine.
Absolutely. There's quite a lot of this stuff, you know, like even in the UK. So, for example, I went a couple of years ago to the Museum of Witchcraft and Magic in Boswell, in Cornwall, and they have like a pin doll of Hitler that like British school children would have played with during the Second World War. So like evacuated school children would have had these like pin dolls of Hitler that they would have stuck needles in an attempt to alter the course of the war. So it's, you know, it's quite a common trope. I mean, in a sense, him shooting at the photograph of Hitler is a similar kind of transference, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose you could see it like that. I mean, when we've talked about this film before off air, you mentioned that this felt very, you mentioned that it's had like an occult vibe.
Well, yeah, absolutely, because it feels as though they are trying to alter the course of events in the only means available to them, namely by sort of sympathetic magic.
Yeah, it does feel sort of very, very magical, like they're trying to invoke this evil spirit of Hitler to sort of, they're trying to almost kill Hitler in that way. Again, kind of going back to sort of a title or the previous title of the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then after that, one of the last things I kind of wanted to talk about is I don't know if this is deliberate, I assume it was, to tie into the ascent. After this section, there's a shot of the moon.
Yeah, of course. I almost wonder if Klimov pays, you know, homage to Larissa Shapitko in choosing to show the moon in the same kind of close-up way that she does in The Ascent.
It would be a very subtle way to do that, I would say.
But of course, in The Ascent, it's a full winter moon, isn't it? Wow, that sounds like a...
it's like a black metal album. Song. It's an immortal album.
It is an immortal album. But this is a summer moon.
Diabolical full moon mysticism.
Exactly. yeah, I'm just thinking, but this is set in summer. And I wondered, like, is it more or less terrifying, the fact that all of this stuff is happening in, you know, in high summer rather than in the dead of winter?
Well, I guess, I mean, the fact is in high summer, I mean, it would just mean that, I suppose, when you've got snow, I guess snow is like an additional element. So in The Ascent, for example, because that's taking place in the dead of the snow is kind of important because the partisan soldiers are kind of fighting against the elements as well. And then this other stuff happens on top of that.
Well, the cast nearly died. I mean, the cast and crew nearly died filming the first, like, 10 minutes of the film. Larissa Shapitko was down for 2 days with fever because of, you know, they were filming for hours in the snow trying to get it right. And they had...
And they all got, like, hypothermia and frostbite.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely unsimulated, shooting for hours. I think so the main actor, I forget his name, he had, like, two body doubles that they were using. And so once one person would get covered in snow, they would get the next one to stand in for them. And they were legitimately struggling because they were filming in a blizzard. So.
Wow. And like Leonardo DiCaprio gets an Oscar for like The Revenant because it's like, well, he had to climb into like, you know, an animal and he had to like, you know, live in like, you know, very freezing cold temperatures.
So did he actually?
Well, apparently they did. Like they tried to do it almost as method as possible, didn't they? But not my point is not to this extent. They didn't almost die.
No, I mean, the cast of The Dawns Are Quiet here, because that was being shot in the summer in a forest in Karelia, which is a region in Russia that borders on Finland. So the water, so they're swimming a lot in that film. The water is like 5 degrees.
Yeah, that's fucking cold.
And in the, and they had a lot of encephalitic ticks in the forests, so the crew were covered in protective clothing, but the cast weren't. They're just wearing their like t-shirts and whatnot. So health and safety is not what it is in Hollywood when it comes to Soviet war films. Both cast and crew are pretty much disposable.
No, I mean that's not that's more than apparent during a scene. It's the only scene that I haven't really mentioned in the film. So it's the scene I kind of referred to earlier with Florian the cow. So Florian's trying to steal this cow, and then there are bullets kind of flying over both of them, which are presumably from Nazis. Now, apparently these were real bullets. They'd not use blanks. So the actor, Alexei Kravchenko, he mentioned in interviews that, you know, these bullets are literally flying about 4 inches above his head. You know, he could actually have been shot and died kind of while making this film. So, yeah, again, not really keen on health and safety in the Soviet film industry at this point. Also not really that keen on animal rights, unfortunately, because the cow, I believe, actually died.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I mean, when Bondarchuk filmed War and Peace, they actually set horses on fire, which I find it very hard to get past that in my mind.
There's it's very, very subtle, but kind of near the end of this film, sort of after the Nazis have left the village and they've set it on fire, and you see kind of Floya, and there's a female Nazi officer who's dying, and he kind of takes a bandage so he can bandage up his rifle. As the Nazis are kind of leaving, you do actually see a horse kind of writhing around kind of on the ground. I don't know if that's if the horse was actually dying at that point, or if it's just been made to look like it is, but it's, you know, very convincing if it was in fact not real, which probably was at this point.
And these are just some of the things why Come and See is the worst date movie ever.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty harrowing stuff. I mean, not only is it based on real life events and it's you know, I'm not saying it's like a documentary or anything, but they were very, very true to life. Again, not that the film is gory, although it does have gore in it, and not that the film is gratuitous or exploitative, because it really isn't. But just the effect of everything that we've talked about on this show today, and say just the way the editing, the shot composition, sort of the different shot types, and just the effect of the amazing score, and just the sound design in general. So the music in this film is composed by Oleg Yanchenko, and it's just amazing. It's just incredible. Like I mentioned, use of like actual kind of classical music and his own sort of droning score. Cow dying, various harrowing scenes of villagers sort of, you know, dead or in the process of dying or mourning, child going through like actual kind of harrowing kind of situations and war. Yeah, just very, very intense film. Very, very intense film. Oh, yeah, and at the end there is, like, actual footage, I think, that's taken from a concentration camp. So, yeah, there is that as well. You know, let's not forget that. So, a very, very bad date movie, but still a great movie and one that's worth seeing, I think we both agree.
Absolutely.
Okay, so if you want to buy this film on DVD, you have many, many options. So the version I own, because it's one of my favourite films of all time, so obviously I own it on DVD, is from Nuvo Pictures, but that is a Region 2. If you live in America, you can buy it on Region 1 from Kino Video. Or if you live anywhere else, there is the Russian Special Edition, which you can buy, and that's a 2-disc. But yeah, wherever you live in the world, a film very, very much kind of worth owning on DVD, I think we should both agree. So I want to thank Miroslava Hartman for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me again. This is our 4th episode together, I believe.
Yeah. Definitely. I should definitely have to get you on again sometime. Is there anything that you want to plug before we go?
So on the 3rd of December, we are launching our 4th charity art niche at the Triptych Gallery. So we're going to have 20 lots. 5 are presented by the gallery, 15 are donated by artists. They're priced at basically between £50 and about £300. Paintings, photographs, graphic art, collages, even sculpture. And 100% of proceeds go towards helping internally displaced children with cerebral palsy. So we're hoping to do as well as we did last time when we sold all 20 lots.
Yeah. So very, very worthwhile cause there. If you want to get involved, obviously you can contact Miroslava on her social media.
Yeah. So I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I am also on Twitter, technically, but I'm not an active tweeter.
It's probably for the best, because Twitter is a fucking cesspool, in my opinion. I hate it so much. But oh well, one must do what I have to do. Thank you very much for finally, Miroslav, for appearing on the show. I want to thank you all very, very much for listening. It's been a wonderful show. I hope you all agree. And I'll see you on the next show for more of the worst date movies ever. Thank you for listening. You can follow me on Twitter and suggest movies for me to review at Worst Date Movies. And don't forget to click subscribe wherever you're listening to this right now to never miss any future episodes of Worst Date Movies ever.